The shooter yelled something right before his shot came in. Could you tell us what that was?
Yeah, it's part of the investigation, John, and we'll, yeah.
Now, the only reason I ask that, though, is, for instance, like with the Unabomber, his brother recognized the writing. So it's possible a friend or family member might recognize if the person said something that was significant.
Correct.
So that's why you don't, other than the 9mm, is there anything else inside that auditorium that you could tell us?
No, that's correct. And listen, like I said earlier, investigations will bring us to evidence that we need to collect in order to be able to prosecute.
With that being said,
we're going to continue to collect evidence, and if it leads us to something to that nature that's going to be extremely helpful for us to identify somebody, we'll be the first ones to put it out.
Alex.
All right. Well, Sandy Rios with you. If you watched any of the coverage of the, well, many attacks that happened over the weekend, that was the Providence police who did not inspire courage. They did not inspire faith in them at all. In fact, the question is, what did the shooter say at Brown University? Everybody says he said something when he shot and killed two people. What did he say? Well, somebody does a follow-up that you didn't hear asking the same thing. Well, it was a blah, blah, blah moment. So we know what he said now. We know what he said, and we're going to talk to you about that today. And also the other shootings, the one in Sydney at the beach, and the one of our soldiers in Syria. This stuff is fascinating and very concerning, and we'll talk about it today on the show. But first, this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Call us, please, at 662-821-2040 and leave a message so that we can hear your voices. It's great to know who's listening. 662-821-2040. It's also great to hear what you're thinking. Also, you can go to sandy@afr.net if you'd rather, you know, send an email kind of telling me what's on your mind. sandy@afr.net. You can find us on social media platforms. And also, you can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, including sandyrios.com, which is my website. It's easy. If you're not a podcaster or you're not used to it, that's very, very simple, sandyrios.com. If not, and in addition, those of you that are American Family Radio listeners and have been for years, because I was on the show on the radio with AFA every morning for 10 years in the morning show. So go to afr.net, and that will, you know, give you a really good way. You just have to look for podcasts, and you'll find Sandy Rios 24/7. Well, it's the Christmas season, and when Mary said, let it, she gives this beautiful, beautiful response when the angel Gabriel tells her she's going to have a baby, even though she's a virgin. It's amazing, honestly, the depth. She says, let it be done to me according to your word. Lord, I know I'm only a kid, and I've never known a man. I don't even know quite what that means. And yet you're going to make me pregnant with a child. I'm going to be facing the disgrace. I've got to explain it to my fiancé, Joseph. But Lord, let it be done to me according to your word. What kind of faith does a girl have to say that? I would say great faith and depth. And when you read that whole Song of Mary, you understand maybe why God chose her to be the mother of his son. It's pretty amazing. Well, today, countless mothers face the same moment of decision when they see their baby on ultrasound, whether to keep it or let it go. They're scared, they're unsure, and their moment to say yes could pass, but you can make a difference right now. Because of the generosity of so many of you who listen and give just generously to preborn clinics, you can save a baby, and you can also save the mom in a different way. Maybe not her life. Chances are not her life, but her eternal life, her eternity, the part of her that'll never die is still to be determined. And it makes a difference how we live our lives and what choices we make. And apart from that, even if she is a believer in Christ, however maybe disobedient she would be to choose an abortion, it's the abundant life that she'll be missing. There's a lot of stake. It's the life of the baby, and it's really the life in a different way of the mother. And so if you'd like to help support preborn, and so many of you have, and I'm so grateful. I truly am. And of course, we could not do this show if we didn't have their support. But if you want to give a really good Christmas gift, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy, and make your most generous donation. All right, this is important stuff because we do have, I think, a global jihad unfolding before our eyes. And you may be having, you know, a lovely Christmas and loving your family. I want you to do that, by the way. But you need to be aware that things are changing. The ground is moving underneath us, and it's happening globally, and it is happening here as well. And we'll talk about that on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something.
All right, Sandy Rios with you, and not playing a clip because I want to set this up for you. We started the weekend by, you know, this killing at Brown of two people, and that's, of course, in Rhode Island, which is kind of a, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of us don't know about those little tiny New England states very much. And so we're going to talk about that in a second because it's great speculation. The shooter, you know, shouted something before he killed those two students and injured others. But the police, you know, don't seem to know. The president of the university doesn't seem to know. The mayor of the town doesn't seem to know. What's going on? We'll talk about that one first. And secondly, then we had, of course, before that even, American soldiers killed in a meeting, in a so-called secure meeting in Syria. This, ladies and gentlemen, is very, very concerning, and we'll talk about it as well. And then, of course, we had Hanukkah celebration, the very first day of it, in Australia at this beautiful beach, disturbed by the murder, the slaughter of 15 Jewish people, little ones, big ones, old, a Holocaust survivor, on the first day of the celebration of Hanukkah. But I'll just make this point before we really make the point later. This is global jihad. Global jihad. And we're going to talk about it. Well, my husband's with me this morning. Good morning, sweetheart.
Good morning.
All right. Have you ever been to Brown University?
I have not. A friend of mine ended up there on a football scholarship, but I have not been there.
I don't know. You know, other than the name, this is all new to me, honestly. And what do you know about Brown?
Well, Brown is a very exclusive Ivy League school. It's located in Providence, Rhode Island, which is a very urban campus. You know, it's not out by itself. It's right in the middle of the town. It's very exclusive to get into. There. Entry grade point averages of 3.9 out of 4.
Oh, my gosh. Think
so
about that.
You know, you obviously are getting students who I guess you would call the cream of the crop. What I did find interesting, though, is you look at how they run their curriculums, though, and it starts to raise questions in my mind. They on their own website, they talk about how they have open curriculums, and they allow for academic freedom. And from what I'm reading, and I have been told this by friends of mine that have attended Ivy League schools, the main thing with an Ivy League, and if I'm wrong, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I've been told this by multiple people, the main thing in an Ivy League school is to get admitted. Once you are admitted, you're sort of part of the clique, and a friend of mine who went to Yale to play football told me that he, who was a very bright guy, he ended up at the Air Force Academy, but he told me that, you know, when you go to these schools, there's so many people that are legacies. In other words, their parents have gone to these schools. Their parents are large donors to these schools. And basically, you know, the administration has to keep these kids in school in order to get their endowment and get the money from the parents. And look, I'm sure there are students who work very hard at Brown University and who study and who do good work, but a lot of these Ivy League schools kind of carry this prestige that probably is not necessarily earned.
Yeah. It's like, a good Midwest school, you might actually get a better education.
Yeah, and, it's interesting. I just saw something where many students who previously were applying to Ivy League schools are now starting to head south and applying to the SEC schools.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me say a couple of more things about what I know, which is, because I've covered the whole issue of lesbian gay before it was transgender, I know from gay men that I've interviewed through the years that Providence is a destination place for gay men. They love Providence. I don't know why. I'm just telling you that as part of the story. I would say that as we saw the students interviewed, I was very impressed with them. They were not ditzy. They were articulate, and they were actually upset at their administration. But let's go into what happened here, Bruce, because this gunman came into this study place, and even the police and the president of the university could not describe what this place was and what they were doing there 6 hours after the attack. But he goes in, and he yells something and kills two. Did he shoot others? Do you remember?
Yes, he has wounded 8 other people.
Okay.
And there's a lot of talk about the police are suppressing what's being told to the press, and that the reason is that it probably involves an Islamic terrorist.
Okay, so before you go into that, they arrested a guy. They told us he was an Army vet. They checked his social media, did a very deep dive, and he was very liberal. And I thought initially that this girl, Ella Cook, who was a strong Christian, the vice president of her Young Republicans Club, and we thought there was talk of her being targeted, which she still might have been targeted, how we know. I thought it was an attack kind of like on Charlie Kirk. That's where my mind went. But now we find out what. What did he actually shout? The police chief's not telling us, but what do we know now, Bruce?
Well, there's been multiple reports from witnesses that the subject yelled, Allah Akbar. The Islamic
God is great. That's what they do when they kill people in jihad.
And that's very typical of these kinds of attacks. They announce that before the attack and then open fire or use a knife or whatever means they're using to kill people. But that's the common thread.
Yeah. So they really have an inept police force. It's just amazing. We don't need to talk about all this because you can watch the news. But they were so slow to show pictures of the suspect, and we just are in the dark, really.
As a former law enforcement person, it was very difficult to watch the press conference with Oscar Perez, who is the police chief of the Providence, Rhode Island Police Department. He's Colombian, but he speaks very good English, and he was not speaking much English that day. He was avoiding the questions. He would say, we'll get back to you with that. We'll get back to you with that. He promised that he would post something online. He did not. There's potentially a lot of problems with this investigation, because when you arrest or detain an improper person, and look, that can happen. That can happen very easily. But it sounds like once they detain this original person who turned out to be released later, a lot of the work stopped, and valuable time was lost.
Eyewitnesses went home. They don't even have the eyewitnesses.
The people that were in the room where these people were shot, they have not even been accounted for. The president of the university, who really looked like a ditz,
Another female president of an Ivy League university.
She was asked,
following the pattern of incompetence, here she is.
She was asked what was going on in this room. She didn't know if it was a test or instruction. She was asked how many people were in the room. She had no idea. She asked if those people that were in that room had been reached out to and accounted for. She had no idea. Now, this was not an hour after the attack. This is a day after the attack, and she still has no idea. So, I would say, if I had to guess from the outside, the police departments are playing catch up on this investigation.
Well, that's a very kind interpretation, or worse. They're not even giving a description of the shooter. And we have a guy, I saw a guy interviewed who's an eyewitness, saw the shooter face to face and said on camera that he thought he was going to die. But we don't know what he looks like. They might ask that guy. Maybe just go ask that guy what he looked like and give us a description. It's very suspicious. And so that's what's happening. But it was, from all accounts, a jihadi attack.
Yeah, so. It's disturbing, too, because, look, I'm not in favor of always releasing all the evidence that's been gathered in an investigation. But in something like this, where now time is becoming crucial, and the way they're going to identify this guy probably is by a photograph or DNA evidence. And this is a school with a, I believe it's a $9 billion endowment. And it's in an urban setting. So your students are at risk. When anytime you have a school, like my brother went to DePaul University, which was in downtown Chicago. Well, you know, you're in an urban environment. It's not safe. And it seems like the police chief was saying, well, we really don't have any video footage. And you know yourself, you walk in the grocery store, they're videoing you. You walk in a train station, they're videoing you. There is video surveillance everywhere. Heck, most people have Ring doorbells now, and they're actually very effective.
And most students have phones, even when they're being attacked, and they take photos of what's going on usually.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if they do have this evidence, they're not producing it. And, you know, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but one thing I think that needs to be factored in here is this is a very prestigious university, and I think they're playing cover your butt here. They don't want to upset the alumni. They don't want to upset the parents of the kids, and so they're trying to make it look like they're doing a lot of work, but really it sounds like they're kind of at a dead end, at least at this point.
It sounds like they're just completely incompetent. It seemed like incompetence on parade. All right, before that, on I believe it was Friday night, two American soldiers, you know, we've been working with this new Syrian president. Now, his name is Ahmed al-Shara. He's also called Julani, I'm saying. I was wondering why I was calling him Julani in my head. That's his other name, Julani. And so the president has decided to work with him. He's actually been in the White House, and there have been a lot of concerns about this. And one of them just kind of is spelled out with Christiane Lamempeur, who is no conservative. She interviewed Ahmed al-Shara on stage at the Doha Forum, and I want you to hear what he said, which will make what happened very interesting. Let's listen.
As you know, you have a past of being a terrorist. I mean, you worked for al-Qaeda. What do you say to people in this room, in foreign capitals, about where your heart and your mind and your allegiance is now?
I think that the question has a lot of issues in it and contradictions, but still I will try to answer the question. Saying that I was a terrorist and judging me as a terrorist is politicized. You know that there are many politicized opinions today. Judging on people as terrorists need to be proven, because what is the definition of terrorism or of a terrorist? It's been 25 years of us hearing this word in the world, but there is a lot of confusion in understanding the word terrorist. Terrorists, in my opinion, are those that kill innocent people, children, and women, and that use illegitimate means to harm people. If we try to extrapolate this description on several countries in the world, we find that the number of victims in Gaza, 60,000 people, most of them are innocent. We saw wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq. All of those that were killed were innocents. And it is the killers that describe others as terrorists.
Very, very clever, I might say, Ahmed al-Shara, the new head of Syria. So, you call me a terrorist. You know, the Israelis in Gaza are killing innocent people. They are terrorists. And then you Americans conducted that war in the Middle East, and all the people that were killed, according to him, were innocent. So then you must be terrorists. And so there we go. I find that so extremely offensive, I can't even tell you. But that's the guy that's in charge that we're working with. Now, many people have been very upset about this. I want to read an article to you from Daniel Greenfield. Daniel has worked with the Horowitz Center. I've known Daniel for years. So he does great writing. He's Jewish, of course, but he's a great writer. And so he says, two American soldiers, members of the Iowa National Guard, and a civilian interpreter were killed in a Muslim terrorist attack. The official press release states that this was an attack by an ISIS terrorist. The Trump administration press release claims that al-Qaeda, president of Syria, Ahmed al-Sharia, is extremely angry and disturbed by this attack, and that it took place in a very dangerous part of Syria that is not fully controlled by him and his government. Well, meanwhile, Daniel writes, there appear to be authoritative reports naming the killer as a member of the al-Qaeda government under al-Sharia al-Jilani, who had been a member of his al-Qaeda group, HTS, and that the attack took place during a meeting to discuss next steps. Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell stated that the attack occurred as the soldiers were conducting a key leader engagement. And he makes the point that an ISIS terrorist should not have access to such a meeting. And so what he's trying to say is, it looks as though the shooter might have been affiliated with al-Sharia al-Jilani, who is not a terrorist. And so he's the one we're working with. Going on, he says, this is Daniel speaking. Three Americans are dead because we're trying to prop up Qatar and Turkey's jihadist state. The excuse that we're fighting ISIS in Syria is utter nonsense. Yes, ISIS affiliates in Syria. So are al-Qaeda affiliates. We just lost three soldiers on the theory that we should be helping the moderate al-Qaeda to fight the extremist ISIS. Daniel goes on to conclude, I'm just reading what he says. No more nation building. No more propping up whoever Tom Barrack's backers are. No more dying for Turkey. No more dying for Qatar. No more dying to nation build Muslim countries on behalf of Muslim terrorists while they kill us. All right, so that's a very strong opinion. I know it is. There's another comment that I want you to hear. This is how, what Daniel said, that's how I feel. That is in my gut. I'm angry. I'm ready to fight. I'm just so angry. Stop it. We can't work with these people. But I heard a comment by Eric McLean. Eric works for the Hudson Institute. And he has a lot, I was very impressed with his knowledge. He was featured on a show that I was watching, I think on Newsmax. And this is what he had to say. Listen, because and then Bruce and I will talk about this.
Hey, good morning. Well, you'll recall that President Trump has a history of extremely strong retaliation when Americans are killed. If you think back to 2019, when the Iranians were engaged in a lot of misbehavior throughout the Middle East, the president demonstrated great restraint right up until an American contractor was killed in December of 2019. Shortly thereafter, the president ordered the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the overall commander of essentially Iranian terrorism in the region. I suspect that what is being planned over at the Pentagon right now is something designed to achieve a similar level of shock within the ISIS structure. We don't know what that is yet, but again, the president has a history of hitting back hard when American lives are on the line. Well, look, I mean, this attack sadly shows that ISIS remains a threat. Radical Islam, broadly speaking, remains a threat. And the United States has an enduring interest in the suppression of this threat, whether it's in Syria or anywhere else where it can mount to the level where it poses a threat to Americans, either there or especially here. The United States has a variety of interests in this region. Syria itself, by the way, its stability in future is a major question for regional stability, which is an interest of the United States. Syria for years was a platform for attacks and terrorism targeting not only U.S. forces in the region, but also our ally Israel. The Iranian influence in Syria has now radically waned. It's being replaced by Turkish influence. The current regime there, led by al-Qaeda veteran of the Iraq War and the Syrian Civil War, Ahmed al-Sharaa, is essentially in a very close relationship with Turkey. If the United States doesn't maintain a level of influence and leverage there, there are all kinds of bad things that could happen for the future of Syria. Whether we like it or not, our interests in the region remain.
See, that's the part that's hard to understand. I will say, just before I ask Bruce what he thinks, we haven't talked about this in so long. These are some basics we learned after 9/11. There are two major branches of Islam. There was a dispute, you can't imagine that, in a religious organization. Can you imagine an argument splitting people up? I can. But they have different views about eschatology, what's going to happen in the end. They look to different leaders, but they come from the same root, which is jihad and all the other stuff that Muhammad wrote in his lovely Quran. And Iran is a Sharia, and Turkey is Sunni. So Al-Qaeda is Sunni. The Muslim Brotherhood is Sunni. Iran is really, it's funny because I think President Obama had more affinity for the Shia branch. I know that seems, that's just a subtlety. I'm just telling you that's what I picked up. But they don't like each other, but they both hate us. So they're in a battle to dominate. Of course, Iran has taken quite a blow when we blew up their nuclear, but they're still very, very present and causing a lot of this problem, as I understand it. Okay, so Bruce, do you have any thoughts about, see, the president came out and said, we will retaliate. There will be, we will retaliate. But who in the world do you retaliate on if this guy's involved with Soleimani, I'll call him the right name, Ahmad al-Shara?
Well, that always seems to be the problem when we are engaged in any kind of interaction in the Middle East, is it seems hard to believe, but identifying who the players are is always one of the hardest things. We always think we sort of figure it out, but there are always underlying tentacles of religious belief, political belief, money, things of that nature that we do not think the way people in the Middle East think.
No, we do not.
That's one of the biggest
problems.
They're
not just like us, which is what Americans often get confused. They're not just like us.
And when you try to approach these kind of problems with the mindset that we have, you're behind the ball already. And I'll just speak from personal observation. When I went to Afghanistan with the FBI in 2008, I remember flying in there and thinking, you've got to be kidding me. You think that we are going to tame this country? We are going to get them on our side? It is like a prehistoric civilization in much of the country. If you think back to the Flintstones, the way they lived in houses that were like made of stone with open windows and things, that's how many of the houses were. People can't read. People can't write. They are destitute. And basically, the people themselves are just trying to find their next meal in many cases. The suppression of women. We just do not understand what's going on in those countries. And then we go in there often with lofty goals. Oh, we're going to get them to understand democracy. We're going to get them to take the aid that we give them and distribute it equally and fairly amongst the people to help the most poor. And I have to tell you, that's a pipe dream.
Yeah, I think so too, Bruce. And yet here we're stuck with this because the world has gotten smaller. And so, you know, President Trump's trying to do business in these countries. I do wonder who's whispering in his ear and what kind of a lack of understanding is being exampled here.
Well, you know, I think one of the ways that we don't factor in often when we're trying to understand these situations, it's the outside financial interests that go on in these countries.
That's right.
Oil companies, construction companies, logistics, things like that. There is a ton of money to be made by outsiders in some of these countries if you get inside. And a lot of the people that are involved in those kind of industries are also major donors to the political parties. So, you know, we'd like to think it's a clean situation where we're just doing what's best for our country and what's best for them, but that is a naive view.
I think so too, Bruce. And so that's as realistic a view as we can give you today without making it I don't know what President Trump's going to do. I'm sure he will do something that will be painful for somebody, and we'll find out what that's going to be, probably in due course.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7. On American Family Radio.
Well, I'm interrupting our discussion with Bruce just for a few minutes with the both of us to just remind you that we have a sponsor, and that sponsor makes these kinds of discussions possible. You know, abortion continues to rise in this country, and as a result of that, preborn is expanding their life-affirming care in the darkest corners of our nation to help more hurting women and save more babies. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a bigger way? In other words, spend more money to save more babies? Your tax-deductible donation of $15,000 would place a machine in a needy women's center, saving countless lives for years to come. Wouldn't it be something to be able to buy an entire machine? I know that some of you probably could do that. And so $15,000, you know, to people who don't have much money, that sounds just overwhelming. But some people don't think anything about writing out $100,000 checks or $500,000 checks. I don't know how many of you listening to me are in that category, but I am inviting you to consider a $15,000 check to buy an ultrasound machine. You know, I don't know. I haven't asked them this, but maybe preborn would even let you know where it goes. Maybe you could even have something to do about where it goes. I shouldn't promise that, but I'm not promising that. I'm just saying maybe. All right. So all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And maybe give that $15,000 to buy that ultrasound machine. And I want to thank you for that in advance for your generosity. All right, well, back to our discussion on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Now, over the weekend, I believe it was on Sunday. Well, who knows what Sunday is in Sydney, because their time is so different from ours. But it was the first day of Hanukkah, the Jewish celebration, the Feast of Lights. It's like their Christmas. You know, it's not the same. Of course, they don't believe in Jesus. But, you know, you wonder, I think Jesus, I shouldn't say this without knowing, but I do believe that, you know, because Jesus was the fulfillment, the Messiah, there's probably not a coincidence that Hanukkah is taking place during the Christmas season, because it's all about light, isn't it? The light has come. But in Sydney and at this beautiful beach, a father and his son opened fire on these, and they stood on a bridge and opened fire on these people that were just having fun, little kids playing games, you know, like a festival, like we would go outside and have kids, you know, face painting and all of that. And they slaughtered 16 of them and killed a shot. And I don't even know. I think a lot of are seriously wounded. I don't know what that number is, but it's big. And so the whole world is just reeling from this. And I think the best way I want to sort of say something about this is the chief rabbi of South Africa. I've played his comments to you before. So we're going to play another set here, because what we didn't fully understand is how bad the Australian government has been on the issue of anti-Semitism. I had no idea. And so I think it would be good to just sit back and listen to this. This is, again, the chief rabbi of South Africa, and listen to his wisdom. Here he is.
The mass murder terror attack in Sydney, Australia, was not simply an anti-Semitic incident that got out of control. It was a professional military operation conducted as part of the global jihadist war being waged on every continent. To plan an operation like this takes time and resources, which was only possible in an environment created by the Australian government that has been conducive to the development of radical Islamist infrastructure, an environment that indulges the demonization of Israel and Jews on the streets, that allows people to chant "Gas the Jews" on the Sydney Bridge, that tolerates and even endorses the genocidal slogan "From the River to the Sea," a call for the extermination of all Israeli Jews. What happened in Sydney is what globalized the Intifada looks like in action, a jihad against the Jews. It is what happened in Manchester, where a terrorist attacked Jews at prayer on Yom Kippur. It is what happened in Amsterdam, where Israeli football fans were hunted down in the streets. And it can happen anywhere, to any Jewish community in the world, because globalize the Intifada means exactly that, hunting Jews everywhere. It is not a protest movement. It is not resistance. It is a jihad of murder, terror, and destruction. Like the original Intifadas launched against the Jews of Israel, the global version has nothing to do with a Palestinian state. It never has. If it were about a state, there would have been one in 1948, in 1967, in 2001, and many times since. The multi-front Islamist war from Iran to Gaza to Lebanon and Yemen is not about a Palestinian state. It is about jihad, the violent spread of a global Islamist movement whose sole purpose is the destruction of the Jewish state first and then the West and the rest of the world. When Western leaders like this Australian Prime Minister and his counterparts in Europe, in response to the Gaza war, recognize a Palestinian state, they endanger themselves. They reward jihadi terror and they make a lethal mistake, lethal to the survival of the free world, because the Jews are only the first target. The jihadists take aim at all infidels. Their slogan says it all. First the Saturday people, then the Sunday people.
And guess what? We are the Sunday people. And I'll follow up with another statement with him by him just a second. But not long ago, you can see video of all these Islamists. You know, they're Palestinian fags. They're, you know, that beautiful opera house, Bruce, in Sydney?
Yes, it's structure. Probably the most recognizable site in Australia. Yeah. It's absolutely beautiful.
So they're covering the ground, covering it, and they're shouting, "Gas the Jews." And that happened not recently. That happened in this past year. They have allowed Muslims to flood Australia, like is the story in Europe. And in Europe, of course, we have the Christmas markets, and the jihadis are destroying those Christmas markets. You know, Europe is, in spite of it being post-Christian, Christmas is still a big deal to them. And I remember going to Edinburgh and Jeremy meeting us at the airport and taking us right to the Christmas market in Edinburgh. It's a very big deal, and the jihadis are after that. Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, as in all things Islamist, there's always a blurring. It's like how we talk about how the Mormons blurred who they were. It's the same thing with the Islamists. And, you know, if you talk to someone who really knows the Quran and who is rational, they will tell you there are several requirements within the Quran that if you are going to be a what they would call a good Muslim, you will kill the infidels. It's not an option. And so what it comes down to, you know, you'll hear people say, oh, well, they're, you know, Muslims are nice people. They're our neighbors and that. And that is possible. But here's the thing. Do not believe these people that tell you there is not a requirement for killing the infidel in the Quran. It's a matter of does the reader of the Quran choose to believe and follow the requirements of the Quran, or do they say, that is not for me. I'm a Muslim, but I don't believe in those things in the Quran.
I don't think they'd hardly ever say it. They just are, you know, it's an easier life for them until Islam starts to dominate and populate, and then they have to make really hard choices, and they'd be the first ones killed if they...
It's like when the Nazis took over in Germany. A lot of people tried to fly under the radar, but eventually the state became so powerful that you had to bend the knee if you were going to survive. And that's the way the Islamists, that's the way it's heading in their world.
Ironically, in this Sydney attack, it was a Muslim who came behind some parked cars and tackled one of the shooters, I mean from behind, in a real act of courage, and brought him down and grabbed his gun. So that's I don't understand that, but he's a vegetable vendor, and he was raised in Australia, and he just said he wanted to thank Australians for giving him citizenship and a home. So that can happen, and we'll discuss that when we have some more time. One last thing in closing. I'm going to close with this. This is, again, Chief Rabbi Goldstein of South Africa with some incredible perspective on what this all means.
We are already seeing this goal being carried out across Africa, from Nigeria to Mozambique, Sudan to Mali. Jihadists are on the march, slaughtering Christians, and in Europe, its capitals, in London, Paris, Berlin and Amsterdam and beyond, have ever-expanding no-go areas governed by Sharia law. What happened in Sydney is not ordinary anti-Semitism. It is part of global jihad. And until the West recognizes that, it faces mortal peril. And that starts with recognizing that Israel and the Jews are on the front lines defending the world against the global jihad. It is about Western governments having the courage to name the evil by calling the attack on Bondi for what it is, a jihad on the Jews. Something that even after all that has happened, the Australian Prime Minister cannot bring himself to do. Until he does that, his countrymen and the free world will not be safe. Abandon Israel and the Jews, and you place yourselves in the crosshairs of the jihadists. Jewish history teaches that those who rise up to destroy the Jews seek ultimately to destroy all that is sacred in the world. When Jewish citizens in the world's democracies call on their governments to protect them from this jihad, it is not merely a call to defend Jewish lives, though that alone would justify decisive action. It is a call to save those societies, because a place that is unsafe for Jews is unsafe for all decent human beings and unsafe for civilized values. Those in the West who chant globalize the Intifada are the academic, political, and media elite of the woke left, who in their hatred for Israel have made themselves the useful idiots of the Islamists, united by a common enemy, the foundational values of Western liberal democracy, values that originate in the Hebrew Bible, the sovereignty and freedom of the individual, the innate dignity of the human being created in God's image, faith, family, personal responsibility, the preciousness of life, the greatness of the human spirit. For the West to survive, it must regain moral clarity and stand for the values upon which civilization is built.
Chief Rabbi Goldstein from South Africa, you know, I just want to remind all of you, yes, he's Jewish, and for some of you who are Christian, that just is foreign to you, and you don't know that much, and maybe you don't have Jewish friends. I'm telling you, it was through the Jews. I want to remind you that God brought his Messiah, that God brought his world, that God first revealed himself. So it's true that a lot of Jews are secular, some are atheists, but for those that are believing Jews, and they really do believe in God's word, they have access to the same wisdom that we have. We are joined at the hip, and someday they will know who their Messiah is. Someone like Rabbi Goldstein, I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I'm pretty sure he at some point is going to understand that Messiah has come. And there's not that wide of a gap between us, except for Jesus, which is a huge wide gap. But I'd encourage you to look at it as a bond rather than a horrible division, or that they're somehow they're inferior because they don't know the Messiah or don't acknowledge him. That's something that God is going to bring about, I hope, soon. And so, honey, thank you for joining me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is very tough, what's going on now. Our Jewish brothers and sisters are really under attack right now.
Yeah, and it's coming for us. That's the part that we have to remember. It is not, it's the people of the book. They're coming after the Saturday people now, and soon the Sunday people. So that's the stated goal for the jihadists, and I just wanted you to be informed. Well, it's Christmas time, and we are so grateful. Aren't we grateful we have a Savior? I was reading in Isaiah just the other day about all the judgments that God's going to bring on various, whether it's Judah and also Israel and all the different sects and cities, and it goes on and on. And of course, in that same book, Isaiah is telling us about the coming of the Messiah, the suffering servant. All we like sheep have gone astray, the plan of salvation. It's just beautiful. But remember, at the time that people were reading this for centuries, they didn't know the Messiah. It was all theoretical. They didn't have the Holy Spirit to make them, help them to live out God's commandments. They didn't have any of that. They were in darkness. Isaiah says, the people who lived in darkness have seen a great light. And he's, of course, talking about the future of the coming of Jesus, the light of the world. And I just want to remind you that we are so blessed to have a Savior, a Messiah who has come, who has provided salvation for the world, for those that accept him. And as you add, you know, to your Christmas thankfulness, add that. The Messiah has come and you know about him. You are not walking in darkness. And I thank God for that in my own life. And I thank God for that in yours. Well, I want to thank my sweetheart. Thank you, honey.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for listening and remind you that Preborn is our sponsor. Go to preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. If you like the show or if you, you know, just you like to save babies, that's a good idea, right? I'll go to preborn.com/Sandy. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.